Hello, I'm Mark Steiner. Welcome. Good to have you all with us. We're going to tackle some of the issues that have been hot in the press, especially around international issues in the United States in the last week. And we are joined here by Bob Summerby in the studio. Bob Summerby, of course, is editor of the Daily Howler. Bill Fletcher joins us. He's the racial justice, labor, and international activist, author of They're Bankrupting Us and 20 Other Myths About Unions, senior scholar of the Institute for Policy Studies, and the immediate past president of the Trans-Africa Forum. Good to have you with us once again, Bill.
Always glad to be on the program. Thank you.
Kathy Kelly's with us, coordinator of the Voices for Creative Nonviolence and co-founder of Voices in the Wilderness. She and her companions helped send over 700 delegations to Iraq from 1996 to 2003. Good to have you back with us once again, Kathy, as well.
Thank you very much. Good to be on the show.
Chris Preble is with us. Did you say it is Preble, right, Chris?
Yes, sir. That's right. Preble.
Preble is the author of three books, including The Power Problem, How the American Military Dominance Makes Us Feel Less Safe, Less Prosperous, and Less Free. And he was a commissioned officer in the U.S. Navy and served on board the USS Ticonderoga from 1990 to 1993, and is vice president for Defense and Foreign Policy Studies. 410-319-8888 is the number here. Write to us at steinershow@gmail.com. You can log on to our Facebook pages. Tweet me at Mark Steiner, 410-319-8888, to join in on this conversation. So let me begin with this is obviously created a huge controversy between right and left and on talk radio and in the halls of Congress. The release of Bo Bergdahl, five leaders of the Taliban traded for him. All kinds of questions going back and forth about his who he was, his family being threatened now. They had to close down any idea of celebrations in his homecoming. So this what became an act of that America cheered at first, watching President Barack Obama with his parents in the Rose Garden, has now become the latest kind of conservative liberal football to be kicked around going after Bergdahl himself and his character. Chris, what are your thoughts?
Well, I wasn't following the story very closely before the announcement of his repatriation. But I knew there were some questions about how it is that he got separated from his unit. Just even as a casual observer, I knew about this these questions, but it never occurred to me that the U.S. government wouldn't attempt to get him back. There's ways to deal with his, how he became separated from his unit. I suspect and I fully expect that he'll have be some kind of a court-martial procedure to determine whether or not he deserted or whatever. But that's something for the Army to determine. We have a military justice system for a reason, and so it never really occurred to me that the implication of the way this debate has broken down is that some would suggest that we never should have attempted to get him back in the first place, and I've never understood that argument.
Bill Fletcher, it's gotten to the place where every week, as Bob Summerby said to me, and he'll talk a bit about this in the green room, that there's something new for the conservative media and the liberals in Congress to go to war over, and this is our latest battle.
This controversy would never be happening if there was a Republican president, regardless of the terms of the exchange. I mean, what's so ridiculous about this is that there's been prisoner exchanges since the times of the wars between Greece and Persia. There's nothing new under the sun here at all. I mean, it's actually absolutely absurd. And there's frequently questions that surround the terms and conditions under which different people are captured. There was a whole controversy about what John McCain actually did while he was in prison. There were allegations about any number of people. That has never stopped the U.S. government from attempting to arrive at some sort of prisoner exchange or release of prisoners. So politics in its most cynical, demonic form.
Bob?
Yeah, I don't know if I completely agree with that, because I think to the naive observer watching this event, I would count myself as one. I'm certainly not an expert on prisoner exchanges. Very few people are. To the naive observer watching this, on face it sounds like a kind of a weird trade. One American soldier for five leaders of the Taliban, as it's been presented. I don't think it's weird that people question that trade. I don't think it's weird that politicians have questioned that trade. But what is weird is the fact, as you mentioned, every week we have to have a different screaming battle. Given the way our discourse works now, every week we have to have a different screaming battle. I said to you in the green room, have you heard Cliven Bundy's name lately? He was the king of all media 5 weeks ago. I mean, he was the biggest thing in American discourse on a Friday. And on a Saturday, Donald Sterling came along, and Cliven Bundy was blown off the scene and hasn't been mentioned since. These are all just frameworks for our shouting matches. But the new framework is Bergdahl, and there's a lot of issues involved here, so it's going to go on for quite a while. But I don't know that it's crazy to question the exchange that was made. That doesn't strike me as a crazy issue to raise.
Mark, if I could just jump in here very quickly.
Bill, go ahead.
You should, to the speaker, consider the prison exchanges that the Israelis have had with the Palestinians over the years, where one soldier will be exchanged for any number of Palestinians. I mean, this is not unusual. People may feel, because they're not engaged in this work on a day-to-day level, they may feel it somehow strange, but it's absolutely not. I mean, all you have to do is do a little research, and therein lies the problem, that we have a politics that's absent context. A politics where people don't pay attention to the facts. They just pay attention to articulating a point of view that they are convinced will set off some sort of explosion. There's nothing unusual about this exchange.
And let me, Kathy, before we open the phones here, why don't we go to you? I'm sorry. Kathy, I didn't mean to leave you out of this. Go ahead.
Well, all that's been said has been quite helpful. You know, the idea of diplomacy, looking for ways in which people might find cooperation, might find mutually beneficial situations, diplomacy, trying to negotiate without using threat and force, seems to me to be what we need much more of. And when you hear that the United States taxpayer monies were used to free Taliban agents, I think we ought to keep in mind that Anatole Levin in the New York Review of Books has asserted that the United States taxpayer monies have been used to subsidize the Taliban over all the years of this war, while the roadways that were used to deliver supplies to U.S. troops were being controlled by people who charged a tax, and many, many millions of dollars have gone to warlords and even to Taliban warlords and drug lords. Wars are always destructive and create conditions that are likely to generate more warfare, more conflict. But certainly the political football playing is very disturbing, to the extent that we now, I think, have reason to worry for Bo Bergdahl's life.
And I think that's part of what's going on, Chris, as well. And I've opened the phones after this. That, I mean, the part of here is this, there seems to be a real move, kind of a character assassination when it comes to Bo Bergdahl and who he was.
Yeah, I think that. Well, that was the point I was getting at the outset. That somehow the circumstances surrounding his separation from his unit and how he got captured, or more generally, his nature and conduct as a soldier, would somehow change whether or not the United States would even attempt to get him back from the Taliban. I wasn't expecting that sort of. That sort of response, although given what has already been raised here on the show, I shouldn't have been surprised, because it's the nature of our discourse that any decision, no matter how innocuous at the outset, is immediately politicized. And I think there is some grounds for criticism as far as President Obama is concerned, and the nature, the way in which this was announced at a Rose Garden ceremony, and the implication that there were, the suggestion or the implication that there were no questions whatsoever surrounding how Bergdahl came to be captured, I think, if anything, it was a little bit tone deaf on the part of the administration.
Well, I think these are the issues. Let me go to the phone chip, but I think these are the issues that need to be explored in some of this, both the criticism over not talking to Congress, to start with, even the intelligence out of Congress, the committee saying, we're about to do this trade for five Taliban leaders. We're holding at Guantanamo, too. No matter your criticism of Guantanamo or not. That's one issue. And the other issue here that kind of disturbs me a lot is the attacks on Bo Bergdahl from people who said they knew him in the army and others. And do you see those who are saying, this was not quite the case, but he's getting very short shrift in the media as well. All you're hearing is the people saying he was deserted, eight men were killed because of him, and others saying, no, that's absurd. But the people saying, no, that's absurd, and the medics saying, look, I knew every man in this unit, it's not quite how it's being portrayed, that you're not hearing at all. That's being played down in the popular media.
Well, you know, the New York Times did a very interesting front page report last Thursday about the allegation that six people died or killed searching for Bergdahl.
I read that again this morning.
I have been begging the media for years. I have been begging the media saying, when false claims are made by major news organizations, that itself is news. That itself is front page news. When major news organizations mislead the American public or misinform the American public, that is news, and it should be reported by other responsible news organizations. I have never seen the New York Times do that. They named CNN and the Daily Beast as two news orgs that were spreading the claim that six soldiers lost their lives searching for Bergdahl, and they challenged that. That was very constructive, and I've never seen – the Times just our news orgs don't challenge each other that way, and that was very constructive. That's part of this discussion. I don't know that it's been completely resolved, obviously, but I think that was a very unusual thing the New York Times did. Hurrah, for once.
But, Bill, the popular media, Bill, is not – I mean, the media that most people watch – when I was at the gym the other day, and you go from CNN to Fox to whatever other news, MSNBC, none of them are really kind of explaining this at all. So the popular perception is very different.
What was interesting, just listening to this exchange, what I jumped back to was the Francis Gary Powers incident in 1960.
U-2 pilot
who was shot down by the Soviet Union. And there was an exchange to get him back. Now, there was some controversy because there were people that felt that Gary Powers should have killed himself rather than have been captured by the Soviets.
Right. I remember that. That's right.
But
right.
So there's always controversy of some sort when it's prisoner exchanges. But the character of what we're looking at right now is different in that, as I mentioned earlier, there's a lack of a discussion about the history of prisoner exchanges. People are acting as if the only kind of prisoner exchanges you can have are for a Medal of Honor winner and some dope from the other side, right, who would never be able to fire a gun if you handed it to them. And that is not the real world. Prisoner exchanges happen for a reason. And part of the thing, and that's what I loved about the last comment about the Times, part of the discussion is that we have to reintroduce some intelligence into these exchanges. We need to reintroduce history so that the general populace understands the context. Now, whether they ultimately will agree that this was worth it or not, I think is a fair discussion to have. But the hysteria that surrounds this is not only not helpful, but it's incredibly dangerous. And as you mentioned, with these threats on Bergdahl's family, I mean, this is beyond absurd.
And I think that there's something we don't talk about a lot as well, which is this increasingly a minority, clearly, but an armed radical right in this country that does threaten people, that has long historical deep roots and other stuff in this country. That to me is pretty frightening to have that happen, you know, and then people also mocking him because he was a ballet dancer. before he went to the army, besides being a crack shot. But also, I'm open the phone to him. I'm going to go back and think about the Vietnam War. And there were a lot of men during the Vietnam War, and men, because at that point it was mostly men fighting the war. There were very few women in the field during Vietnam at all. But there were a lot of men who in that war who said, something's not right with this war, and I don't want to do this anymore.
There were a lot of men.
A lot who did that.
In and out.
Right, who did that.
Right.
And I think this is also part of this conversation. But let me come back to them. Let me open the phones first. 410-319-8888. Bruce, you're on the air.
Yeah, so I agree. Let's introduce some intelligence into this conversation. I hope that doesn't sound arrogant. But first off, let's get one thing straight. This isn't the Israeli-Palestinian issue. Number one, don't confuse it with that. That's a separate issue. That's not this issue. Number two, your guest has said he was separated from his unit. He wasn't separated from his unit. He left on his own free will. So, and the other part of it is, a lot of combat soldiers through every war are disillusioned or have doubts about what they are, what's going on. That's normal. But you still go on what your duty is. So that's the other part of it. You know, and he's made a lot of statements before he left. And you should also look at military statutes. I'm not an expert on this, but let's get this straight. If you're in the military, even if you're stateside, even in peacetime, if you leave any type of military installation without authority, without proper orders, you're AWOL. So he was AWOL. And this is overseas in an area where there's been combat, where there's been a lot of combat, and it's a combat situation. He not only left his country down, he left down his other platoon members. And you listen to the majority of the platoon members and the people that are part of his division, what they had to say. You listen to what the military people have to say.
Okay.
Barack Obama,
stop yelling, Bruce. The yelling is not, you can finish your thought, but if you can do it without screaming through the microphone, that'd be great. Bruce? Okay. So let us do tackle what he was saying. Chris, you want to grab it first, please?
Yeah, I mean, this is what I said at the very beginning. I said we have a military justice system, and the caller is right that if someone leaves a post, even here in the States, and they're absent without leave or unauthorized absence, then they're going to be investigated, and they might be under a court-martial. They might be punished. That's appropriate. I think that's appropriate in this case. But I don't think that's the same as saying effectively we're going to try him in absentia through the media and determine that because he left his unit under curious circumstances that we're not going to bother to bring him back, essentially sentencing him to torture and possible death at the hands of our enemies. Is that what we've come to? Have we given up on the military justice system? I think that's a real indictment of the military and the Army specifically. I mean, the Army has jurisdiction here. They should investigate this. But I don't think that's the same as saying we should just sentence him in absentia and just don't bother to try to bring him back.
We're going to take a brief break and come right back, and I'm going to go right to Kathy Kelly for a comment on what Chris just said and open the phones and let Russ come in. And then I'm going to switch gears a bit here and talk a bit about what President Barack Obama has been saying in Europe, which I think when we talk about future confrontations, let's talk about what's happening in Europe right now and also the experience that Kathy Kelly had in Korea. We are going out with Jackie Wilson, Born on This Day, Higher and Higher, one of his great songs. That's why I love you so, Jackie Wilson. So, we go back to our conversation here. We are joined by Bob Somerby, editor of the Daily Howler, Bill Fletcher, racial justice, labor, international activist, author of The Bankrupting Us and 20 of the Myths About Unions, Chris Preble, who is vice president for defense and foreign policy studies at... he's author of three books, including The Power Problem, How the Military Dominance makes us less safe, less prosperous, and less free. And it was a commissioned officer in the U.S. Navy, Kathy Kelly, coordinator of Voices for Creative Nonviolence and co-founder of Voices in the Wilderness, a campaign to end economic sanctions in Iraq. And Kathy, why don't you jump in before we go back to the phones?
Well, thank you. I do appreciate what Chris is saying, that there is a system in place if people are found to have left their position. I do think, however, that all of us have a right and a responsibility to ask questions about the military dominance in our country, to ask questions about whether or not it's possible for someone to have a crisis of conscience and maybe be willing to face the consequences, as we've seen with so many of the recent whistleblowers. And I also think it's important to now push the question of whether or not all of the detainees in Guantanamo who've been cleared for release might be released, if in fact it's possible to release five people who were declared members of the Taliban. So there are many, many questions to be asked, not in a spirit of hysteria, not in a spirit of trying to promote political football, but because the U.S. public has, as part of our democracy, a right to information. Democracy is based on information and education, so it's a good time to ask questions.
Let me open the phones here, and then I'm going to ask a question about where we're going, where Europe is taking us, at 410-319-8888. And Russ in East Baltimore, you're on the air.
Greetings, Mark, to you and your guests. Mark, it never ceases to amaze me how adept we've become at hitting the bullseye on the wrong target. What we're talking about with Bergdahl, I have, as a Vietnam veteran who served in the chain of command and led men in combat, I have real strong suspicions about their timing and their motives. First of all, whatever happened with Bergdahl, he was a PFC when it started. The military saw fit to promote this man to Specialist 4 and into the ranks of a non-commissioned officer, a sergeant. Where were these guys then when this was going on? Did they want him to become a non-commissioned officer as a suspected traitor? But I think there's an overarching issue here that we're missing. Bergdahl's situation comes to light because of a failed policy. Bergdahl's unit was up forward with six men, two fire teams, doing a mission that probably should have been done by a squad, 11 to 15 men, if not a reinforced squad of 15 to 22 men. I go back to what Bruce says, and he really doesn't understand what he's talking about, because rubber guard is done in the exterior and the overseas, on the interior in the United States, continental United States. I don't know any doctrine from which a strategy or a tactic would flow where you assign one soldier to an overnight guard post. That's asking for trouble. Two, Bergdahl, and when I listened to the people who criticized him, should have been evacuated because he gave them enough signs that if they had any training in PTSD, which the chain of command should have had, to recognize his situation. He was acting in a way that made his fellow soldiers feel uncomfortable. He should have been evacuated to the rear for evaluation. But you see my point? He couldn't be because they were already shorthanded. And this goes back to the real doctrine, beginning with Iraq, cash in since 74 the second time, which was my point I wanted to bring on before, because here's a guy that told them that you need 350,000 people to do Iraq. They didn't listen to him. They broke the army in the process and then put people in a situation where they have to be deployed five, six, seven, eight times. When do we stop looking at people and look at the doctrines and the stupidity of our leadership that leads us into these situations? Thanks, Mark, for letting me vent.
Thank you, Russ, very much. Good to hear from you. It's been a while. And so let me go to Bill Fletcher and then to Chris. Bill?
Brilliant. What we just said. I mean, I wish that MSNBC and Fox would put that brother on to articulate that. I mean, what was really amazing about the other caller, I think Bruce or whatever his name was that the intensity of his words would lead someone to believe that he actually was on the ground in Afghanistan or had been, and that he actually knew the facts of the situation. He was so determined. See, this is where this whole discussion becomes completely absurd. That you have this intensity when people don't know what they're talking about. There has not been an investigation, and as Chris pointed out, there is a judicial process that the military has. You investigate someone. If you need to bring them to court-martial, you do that. But this notion of convicting him in the media and thereby convicting Obama, it just, again, it goes back to the cynicism of this whole exchange.
Chris?
I appreciate the caller's remarks. I mean, it is true. We should continue to draw distinctions between Iraq and Afghanistan. I think we should. I think these are different conflicts, and they were engaged in for different reasons. And I think there was a lot more support for the war in Afghanistan at the outset, for obvious reasons, and now there's much less. But the point stands that we've put our men and women in uniform, our frontline troops, into truly impossible situations. Many of them have performed admirably, even heroically, given those impossible situations. But at the end, we really should be asking ourselves, what has this all been about? And that it is a frustration. We're focusing on the trees and losing sight of the forest.
Let me also apologize, Chris. Earlier, when I said you were Vice President for Defense and Foreign Policy Studies, I left out a very important point of the Cato Institute. Yeah. So I apologize for that, Chris. Sorry.
Let there be no confusion. Yes, thank you.
So I didn't believe I did that, so I apologize.
I thought it was for the whole world.
Yeah, right, exactly. I got a promotion.
So let me ask another question. Let's switch gears for a moment here in the limited time we have left. One of the things that struck me as I was driving the other week and listening to National Public Radio was hearing President Obama speak in Europe and then saying we need to push to spend $1 billion in defense, and you need to up your defense spending, France and Germany and other countries, in the face of what's happening with Russia. Let's talk about a bit about that. I've been taken aback by this ever since the beginning of this Ukraine crisis, when it just seemed to me, and maybe you all will disagree with this, but when it seemed to me that once again our government was supporting kind of the overthrow of an elected government, a government we may not have liked, but was duly elected, as was Morsi's, as were several other ones we can mention. Your thoughts on that? Let me start with Chris. I know you have to leave in a couple of minutes, and then go to Kathy and go around the room. Chris?
Well, right. I've written about this in general, and I wrote about it specifically in response to the president's announcement last week. The fact is that our allies, especially our NATO allies, consistently spend less than 2% of GDP on defense, and it's really quite inadequate, and especially inadequate when you think about how much we spend to defend them. Now, again, if I were in their position, I'd probably do the same thing, because after all, people aren't inclined to pay for things that other people will agree to pay for them. You'd be a fool to do that. And I think that that's what we see. And so the president's announcement in Poland last week really, really puzzled me, because surely he doesn't think that offering to give an additional $1 billion to the allies, when in fact we've been subsidizing their defense for decades, will induce them to spend more on their own defense. Why on earth would that be? It's really cognitive dissonance on the part of the president, and I think there's more. To me, it's a speech that's intended for two different audiences simultaneously, trying to convince the American people that we're going to get our allies to do more to defend themselves, but convincing the allies not to do more because we have to all have their back.
Is it just me, or does $1 billion sound like not very much?
It's a joke. It's a rounding error, both in terms of the U.S. Security expenditures, but also in terms of Europe. We have to remember the EU collectively has a GDP larger than the United States, so they certainly could afford to spend a bit more on their militaries if they saw the need to do so, but of course they don't.
Kathy, and then go to Bill, and come back over here to Bob.
You know, I really have to confess I'm in a moving vehicle as part of a 160-mile walk from Chicago to an Air National Guard base that's being turned into a place to launch drone warfare. And I have lost track of the conversation. I'm not sure if you can hear me, but I'm sorry I wasn't able to hear Chris. I'll stay on the line, and maybe I'll be able to get a better signal
okay.
soon.
We can hear you.
Hear
you. So, Bill, I'll come right back to Kathy. Bill, why don't you jump in, and then...
Yeah, I think the discussion is beginning in the wrong place, although I think, Mark, you were starting in the right one. Why are we in this provocative mode with Russia? I mean, first of all, how many military bases does Russia have around the world? And let's contrast that with the number of military bases the United States has. The second thing is that there was an agreement that the Russians were operating under, beginning under Gorbachev in the Soviet Union, that NATO would not expand. NATO has consistently violated that agreement and has been pushing up against the Russian border. Again, have people forgotten their history?
What happened prior to World War II? What was it that the then Soviet Union was so particularly concerned about? Ah, could it have something to do with the fact that there were these right-wing dictatorships at the time that were pressing up against their border, many of which were allied with the Nazis? I mean, come on, folks. I mean, let's look at history and let's understand the situation. Why are we pushing the envelope? You don't have to agree with what the Russians did in Crimea. I happen not to. But I also think, Mark, what you were raising was, in the beginning, was very important. The way that Europe and the United States operated in as the Ukrainian crisis was unfolding was completely irresponsible. It was analogous to the way that Germany acted when Yugoslavia was in the middle of crisis, encouraging Slovenia to pull out and then ultimately setting the dominoes going. I think that we have to be very careful. So before we start talking about more defense against what, right? It's not that the Russians are expanding military bases overseas. It's not that the Russians are going into Poland. I mean, let's pull back and look at the situation and add a little history to it.
So go ahead, Bob. And I'm going to get Chris in here before he has to.
Yeah. Run. Well, the question, have people forgotten their history? The answer is often going to be no, because, you know, we, including myself, we don't know the history. And it's just for myself, as someone who follows the press corps, I'm not a foreign policy expert, I'll just say what I said in the show before. During the time when the Ukraine situation first became current, and going back to our press corps and CNN, those were the 7 weeks the CNN was trying to find the missing plane all over the world, and they had to squeeze in 20 seconds of Ukraine in between their 59 minutes and 40 seconds of which part of the ocean should we look in today, and, oh, by the way, all of our information yesterday is wrong today. So that's the nature, and, you know, it's very difficult for people to know their history or know world history if our press corps is going to work that way, and that's part of the way the press corps worked on the Ukraine matter.
Chris, you want to jump back in?
I'll just say this: I don't think we disagree as much as it might seem, in the sense that I remember the history quite well. I'm a historian by training, and my colleagues opposed NATO expansion in the late 1990s, and were one of the only ones in the Washington D.C. area to do so. So I think there's the valid point to be made that choosing to expand NATO into the former Warsaw Pact countries was unnecessary. But by the same token, I think the European countries who feel threatened by Russia, but feel no particular need or incentive to do anything about it, that is a legitimate line of questioning. And I think we have, in effect, infantilized these countries. We have discouraged them from taking reasonable steps to defend themselves, and they have taken they have followed our lead. We have discouraged them from doing that, and the deal is we agree to defend the Europeans, and they agree to let us, and it's a great deal for the Europeans. It's a lousy deal for the United States, and I say let them, if they have a serious concern about threats, and I think we should have a discussion about threats, is this threatening or not, but it's a lot easier for us at the remove of 4,000 or 5,000 miles from the Russian border to say that Russia is or is not a threat. I dare say the Baltic states feel differently. I dare say Poland feels differently. Let them have that conversation. But as it is right now, we, the United States, are on the hook for defending them. And if you look at their pattern of behavior over the last 15 or 20 years, they've consistently spent less and less money on their security at a time when they claim to be more threatened.
So I'd like to jump in, if I may.
Kathy, go right ahead.
Thank you. You know, I think we've all been told again and again that our security lies in being able to have a stronger military. I think the greatest terrors we're all facing are the terrors of what we're collectively doing to our own environment, global warming, climate change, depletion of resources, pollution of resources. And I think that the reason countries often don't have enough money to attend to the human needs of people within their own country is because they're forced into spending more and more money on the military. And that's the example that the United States has set, and that's what the U.S. continually demands from others. I think it's incredibly important to go back to that history. Gorbachev was told that one more inch would the United States be pushing further and further, or NATO be pushing further and further toward the Russian border, and then exactly the opposite was done. The ABM treaty was ripped up. If we could ask ourselves, have we been in error in terms of our readiness to live equitably and to share resources with other people on the planet, then I think that European countries might feel more trustful of the United States. But we keep on saying we're the exceptional nation. We're above the rules. We don't even have to consult the playbook that we would impose on others.
So I know, Chris, probably you have to run. I want to say thank you for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Vice President for Defense and Foreign Policy Studies at the Cato Institute, not the world.
Not yet.
Not yet. Thank you.
Chris, thanks so much. Great to have you with us once again. Thank you. Let me go back what we were just kind of covering here. I think that this is really, I think that we don't really discuss with any seriousness in our media other places what our foreign policy is and the effect it's having. What we're actually doing. We seem to be just disengaged in this aspect of our lives, Bill Fletcher. Really just disengaged.
There's no question about it. And this is one of the reasons, and you have to forgive me, Mark, that I've been going on this rant about history. The problem is you can't engage in a real discussion about foreign policy in the absence of history. And this is what most people around the world understand. We in the United States just simply do not. We have a view of history which is that history is irrelevant and that the only thing that's important is the future. And so we keep making a series of mistakes, and we end up engaging in these ludicrous discussions. The discussion about what's going on in Ukraine, there's so much that's been missing. For example, there's been very little discussion about the right-wing forces that operate in Ukraine that have a history that goes back to the years of the Waffen-SS and the support of a substantial part of the Ukrainian population for the German invasion in 1941. And yet this is not entered into the discussion. We act as if the overthrow of what was actually a very corrupt government was just simply the uprising of an enlightened democratic people. It was a mixed bag. And when the United States and Europe start trying to seduce a country, they're playing with fire, and that's what we have to understand as the populace, as the electorate.
And I think that's absolutely true. We tried to do this program at the beginning of this whole thing with Ukraine because people do not understand the history and also relationship of Ukraine to Russia. Also, even though people have issues with Crimea being taken by the Russians, it was always part of Russia until Khrushchev signed a peace paper giving it over to Ukraine for his own reasons.
That's right.
You know, I'm saying this is a very complex thing. People don't get into the complexity.
Maybe we should have traded it for a Bo Bergdahl. I mean, that could have been part of the deal.
Touché.
You know, I often wonder how many – we talk about the discussion of this of topics like this versus our discourse, which now runs on topics like Clive and Bundy. And I just wonder how many people follow a discussion, a topic like this at all. I would assume very few. So there's very little – when we talk about a discussion going on in the country with topics like these, as opposed to the things that our seven-figure leaders are yelling at each night on cable, I just wonder to what extent there's a discussion at all, except among certain elites who – foreign policy elites in this case – does the average person follow this at all? I have to say, I doubt it.
Well, one reason we do it on the air.
Absolutely.
The airwaves,
yes.
So people can have
yes.
a discussion.
But this is a very unusual situation.
So, and Kathy, before we have to run, there's something I wanted you to bring up to us, just as a point of information for us to hear. I had not heard about it until my producers chatted me this morning on the internet. You had just come back from Korea, and you were making a connection between what's happening in Europe and the demonstrations taking place in Korea around a military base. What happened in Korea that we're not hearing on the news?
Well, it's certainly a matter for history. For the past 7 years, a small village, the Ganjeong village on Jeju Island off the southern peninsula of Korea, has been trying to prevent the creation of a naval station that would accommodate United States nuclear subs, United States naval aircraft carriers. And these are people who say, we've got one of the most pristine shorelines and ecosystems in the world. They've been given multiple UNESCO designations as being valuable spots on our planet. And the United States just throughout that area trying to choke off the South China Sea trade route as a potential threat against China has been militarizing the islands. In Okinawa, they're trying to do it, Jeju Island in South Korea. And the idea is to keep provoking China, keep displaying U.S. intent to be able to contain China, rather than have a pivot toward equitable and fair ways of sharing resources, which would make so much more sense for the future, and also acknowledging how our militarization in Korea has adversely affected people on that particular island, where 30,000 people were massacred in what they call the April 3rd massacre, which the United States collaborated with. It's so true that we need to better understand the history before we continue to tell other nations, you either subordinate yourself to U.S. foreign policy goals, or we'll find ways to eliminate you.
I think, Bill, that's part of what we're talking about here, is that we're seeing what you were commenting on, that when we look at the United States foreign policy and what we're doing across the globe and the military bases we have around the globe and what that's doing to kind of heighten the tensions around the world, and we don't wrestle with that either.
We always seem to be in search of another war. We always seem to be in search of another situation. I mean, if you know, you think back to George Bush the First and the end of the Cold War and the alleged peace dividend, and before we had an opportunity to talk about a peace dividend, we were in a conflict in Iraq. I mean, this madness continues, and unfortunately, there's not enough programs like yours, Mark, where this kind of very intelligent discussion can take place. But I think this is part of the fight that we actually have to engage in so that more people understand. See, part of the problem is that history is taught so poorly in general in the United States. It's taught as just a series of facts that it becomes very boring and people disengage. And then when they turn on the media and they get these very quick clips about places they may never have known of, may not know how to spell, may have no sense of the history, there's a disengagement because you feel like at the end of the day you actually don't need to know about Ukraine.
So this has been a really fascinating discussion. Bill Fletcher, it's always a pleasure when you're on the program with us. Thank you so much for joining us again. Senior scholar at the Institute for Policy Studies, media past president of the Trans-Africa Forum. Kathy Kelly, it's always great to have you. Please come back more as a guest. It's always great to have you on the air with us, and look forward to talking to you more about the things you've been doing to get those conversations on the air as well.
Thank you, Mark.
And my old friend, Bob Somerby, thanks for the Daily Hollow. Thanks for coming in the studio.
Thanks.
And also my thing earlier was with us, Chris Preble, who is Vice President for Defense and Foreign Policy Studies at the Cato Institute. We are going to take a quick break, and you'll be listening to I'll Be Satisfied by Jackie Wilson. It's his birthday today. And Mr. Excitement. And then we'll come back and talk about this anniversary, the Six-Day War, with two of our guests coming from Israel and one in the studio to talk about what this occupation has meant since. Stay with us.
That's all I need. That's all.